Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Chief, you know, there's two things in this world I hate to miss. One's a Lakers game and the other's Rich Rossi Live. You gotta be cuckoo to miss this show, you know what I mean, pal? And wait till you get a load of what Rich is gonna talk about today.
What we're gonna talk about today is my favorite book of the Bible, the Gospel of John. As a teenager, I got interested in the Bible. We had a Bible. We were raised Catholic, and the Bible was sometimes read or referred to. There's a nun, Sister Carol Ann, in my grade school. Occasionally, we'd get out the Bible and talk about it, but it wasn't something we read a lot. And I asked my mom, could I borrow the family Bible? And I started reading John. It had 21 chapters, which was my favorite number because my favorite baseball player, Roberto Clemente, was 21 for the Pirates. And I thought, you know, I'm going to read three chapters a day. There's 7 days in a week, and I'll get through it. And I just kept doing that week after week after week, and I ended up memorizing large portions of John and loving John. It got me very interested in Jesus and believing in Jesus and following Jesus. And I'm really elated that today we could talk about John in a more substantial way than I've probably ever talked about it with an expert on the Gospel of John, a distinguished professor, author, Paul Anderson. He's been teaching since the 80s on a college level in the issues of the Gospel of John and theology, and I'm really excited to have him come on, and we can talk about even some of the controversies and questions about the Gospel of John. And we'll be back with Professor Paul Anderson in about 25 seconds. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Rich Rossi Live. We are so honored to welcome Professor Paul Anderson, who's written several books on the Gospel of John. And welcome, Professor Anderson. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Richard, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, you are most welcome. One thing that hit me when I first started reading John was just how different it was than the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that it starts off almost sounding like Genesis. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, very metaphysical. What makes John so unique to you as a professor, as a teacher of John?
Yeah, thanks, Richard. The Gospel of John, we sometimes call it the fourth gospel because it's listed after Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is the most different. You're right. It begins with a worship hymn to Christ, the Word. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. This worship piece is set in verses and probably represents the early worship life of the early church. From there, you go on into the stories of Jesus, which are rendered in terms of God's love for the world. John has eight miracles, but only five of those are in John alone. Three are in some of the other Gospels, but John has a lot of different material from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So in that sense, it's very distinctive.
Now, you said there were eight miracles in John, and did you say that five are unique to John? Did I hear that right?
Yes, five are unique to John.
So we have the first one, the water into wine is the first one. Whenever I've shared that with friends of mine that aren't religious, they love it. They were like, wow, this guy's a lot cooler than I thought. He's making wine for the party here.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, and then there's a healing from afar in Capernaum.
Mm-hmm.
And then Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't have any miracles that are in Jerusalem. But John mm-hmm. has the healing of the lame man by the pool. And then there's the healing of the blind man by mm-hmm. another pool. And then there's the raising of Lazarus in Bethany. So mm-hmm. those five miracles are unique to John.
That is, wow, I didn't know. That's so interesting. One thing I love about John, too, I think, Professor Anderson, is how there's this very individual approach to people. Like in John 4, the woman at the well, he has a very unique message that, hey, I know you've been looking for love in the wrong places, and you've been married five times and living with a guy. And then Nicodemus, he says, you must be born again. And the reason I liked that was I was, in my younger years, around fundamentalists that had a very methodology of evangelism, where they give the same spiel to everybody, be it the four spiritual laws, or there's a guy down here in Southern California that's on the promenade in Santa Monica, and he has a kind of a trap. I call it Christian mugging, where he leads them through these questions of, have you ever committed adultery? Have you ever lied? Have you ever done this? Well, then you're an adulterous, lying sinner. You're going to go to hell. But I notice with Jesus, it seems in John that, be it the woman at the well or Nicodemus or anyone he encounters, there's a very individual, unique approach in these one-on-one encounters. And that really, really struck me when I read it, and still does.
Yeah, these dialogues with Jesus and John are especially extended and personal. You have even the beginning of John, where John the Baptist points to Jesus and says, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Then you have Andrew bringing along Peter, his brother, and you have Nathanael coming to Jesus along with Philip. And so it's like people experience themselves being known by God or known by Jesus in his talking with them. And that's the way it is with the woman at the well. You know, she says, "Oh my goodness, he's told me everything I've ever done." Now that's slightly overstated, but that sense of being known by God in the presence of Jesus, I think is one of the ways that the Gospel of John, its story of Jesus, speaks to later generations.
Yeah, it really does. I was thinking this morning on Psalm 139. My aunt recommended this little daily reader that my wife and I read in the morning. And the thing for this morning was Psalm 139, about how God knows every thought before we think it and every word before we speak it. And I love that to John. You mentioned John 129, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." I've thought a lot about this, and I know in your book, The Riddles of the Fourth Gospel, you bring this up as one of many, many tensions that you bring up. Is it universal or specific, what Jesus is offering? And the John 129 sounds very universal in saying he is the Lamb of God, he takes away the sins of the whole world, and yet there's other verses in John that seem very he that believes is saved, but he that believes not or is not baptized shall be damned, things like that. But yet there's this feeling of universalism as well. I know you've written extensively about that. What are your thoughts on that tension?
Yeah. Well, in Riddles of the Fourth Gospel, I outline theological riddles or tensions, and then historical problems, and then literary problems. So the theological tensions, and I limit myself to 12 in each of those categories, but like the theological tensions include such huge issues like the humanity and divinity of Jesus. I mean, John shows the most human and the most divine presentation of Jesus in the New Testament. In John, Jesus is equal to the Father but subordinate to the Father. Eschatology is present, but it's also future. The item that you're mentioning, I think, is one of the most significant ones among people that I talk to today, which relates to salvation. On one hand, John has the most exclusive presentation of salvation anywhere in the New Testament. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through him. Then again, John is the most universal. John 1:9. The light of Christ enlightens everyone. This is the light that has come into the world. And so you have that universal aspect of God's light that is available to every person, you know, whether they're a Christian or not a Christian, whether they come from Western culture or from Eastern culture or some other place. So John has the most inclusive and universal presentation of God's revelation at work in people's lives. Now, one of the ways that I address these tensions is to ask, okay, are they contradictory? It could be that they're just plain contradictory. And if that's the case, then John, as a narrative, you know, might not be worth believing. But if both aspects might be true in some way, according to the writer, then the question that I bring to the text is to ask, okay, if they're true, how are they true? And as I'm looking at John 14:6, maybe the issue has to do with John 6, 44 and 45. There the text says, no one can come except being drawn by the Father. So it's not a matter of no one may come. It's not a matter of God having a rule and saying, sorry, wrong answer, you go to hell. but it's a matter of no one has seen God at any time. No one can come to God except that God draw them to God's self. In that sense, maybe the reason that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life is not that God has a requisite for people to get in. You got to get the right answer or you go into hell. Maybe the issue is that the only hope for humanity is God's saving initiative. It's what God has done. It's not what humans have done. And so, like when you go back to the prologue, all who receive the light become children of God. And then verses 12 and 13, they go on to say, children not of human plan or man's will, but children that are born of God's initiative. So the issue really is resting in what God has done. And that's why no one can come to God except by responding in faith to what God has done. And of course, what God has done from John's perspective, God has spoken at many times and in many ways, but now he has spoken in his son, Jesus Christ, inviting people to receive God's love. Does that make sense?
It does, you know, and it also brings up, I guess, another tension, Professor, and that is the whole, free will versus, I guess it would be Calvinism or predestination, like some of the sentiments that we can't come unless the Father draws us. In John 15, he also says, you've not chosen me, I've chosen you. And yet there's other elements of John where it seems like you got to make a choice. You know, classic John 3:16 presentation, you know, that we see. You mentioned in your book how we always see that at the baseball games and highway billboards, you know, that we all have to choose to believe.
Yeah, yeah.
That seems like another one of those two sides to the coin, too. It feels like another one of those are both true in a way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And part of the way that I would see that is that, again, it's not the human initiative, but it's that God is reaching out toward us. And so people are invited to respond to God. And you know, as I'm looking at John 1:9, the light of Christ enlightening everyone, at least potentially. The way that George Fox might talk about that is speaking about that which is of God in every person. And so from an evangelist standpoint, I think the way that John would talk about things is inviting people to be open to their understanding of God's presence. What do they know of God's truth? And to respond to that in the affirmative is what it means to believe. So belief in John is simply a response of faith to the divine initiative. And in that sense, all people are invited to do so.
Hmm. Also, John 6, you mentioned that a moment ago. Another interesting debate I've heard, I'd be curious to get your thoughts. As one raised Catholic, and then later I was a part of a lot of different evangelical and fundamentalist groups, as Catholics, that was taught, you know, when if you won't eat my flesh and drink my blood is a literal thing with communion and the Eucharist. This kind of sifts down the crowd, I think, if I remember rightly, where it might be just him and Peter, and he's, are you going to go too? And he's, I don't have anywhere else to go. But has that been something that's come up for you in teaching John about, you know, is this a metaphor or is he really referring to the communion that we would remember him? I know some churches do the ordinance of sacraments and some don't. Has that come up for you, or do you have any thoughts on that part of John 6?
Yes, and actually John 6 is what I did my doctoral study on at University of Glasgow as the key to understanding John and the synoptics, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because they also have the feeding of the 5,000 and the sea crossing in the other Gospels. And so basically I use that as a way of asking, what are John's literary and theological and historical tensions and where are they coming from? Rudolf Bultmann put it this way. You see, because the Gospel of John at the Last Supper doesn't have the institution of the Eucharist. And so that might even raise some questions for some scholars, saying, oh my goodness, how could this be an apostle if he wasn't there for the big deal? And therefore, John was not written by an apostle. Well, I don't know that that's the way to go with that. Most scholars say, well, he did talk about the Eucharist, but he put it after the feeding of the 5,000 instead of at the Last Supper. Well, I do think we have Eucharistic language. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in yourselves. So that's verses 53 and 54 of John 6. But the question is, what is meant by eating and drinking? The way that I come at that, now Bultmann argued that if that is saying that the Eucharist is indispensable for salvation, then that kind of denies John's Christ-centered approach to salvation, of just being the way, the truth, and the life. So Bultmann thought that could not be written by the same person. It must have been added by an editor or a redactor. As I'm looking at that though, I don't think that it's saying you must participate in instrumentalist sacramentology or a sacred meal. I think it connects with verse 51. The bread that Jesus gives for the life of the world is his flesh. I think that's talking about the cross. And in that sense, it's saying, unless you're willing to suffer and die with Jesus, then don't expect to be raised with him in the afterlife. So I see that as calling for people to be faithful to Christ, even if it involves the cost of discipleship. If I could just mention one parallel in the Gospel of Mark. When Jesus says to James and John in Mark 10:38-39, are you willing to drink my cup and be baptized with my baptism? They say, we are. He says, you shall be. This is not saying, okay, get liturgical or else. It's saying, are you willing to suffer and die with me? Are you willing to commit faithfulness, even if it involves the outcome of a martyr? And so that's another example where baptismal and Eucharistic overtones are used to talk about martyrological faithfulness. And so that's what I think is going on in John 6. Jesus is saying, are you willing to embrace the cross?
So did I, just to make sure I got it right, for our listeners, did you see that Bultmann argued that the John 6, if you're not willing to eat my flesh and drink my blood, was added later to give it a Eucharistic bias that does not square with John 14:6, where salvation is simply Christ? Did I hear that right?
Yes. Bultmann, yeah. This is one of the elements. Okay, so Bultmann is dealing with John's theological tensions, of which that is one, by saying, oh, there must be different authors. And so Bultmann had a very complex theory of composition, three major underlying sources, the evangelist writing a narrative, the thing falling apart, and then the final editor putting together in the wrong order. And so Bultmann puts it together in what he says is what he thinks is the right order, and therefore you come up with Gnostic poetry. Well, my approach was to just look at all of his evidence, and frankly, it's not compelling. I do think that John has a couple of additions. I think an editor helped things out, but I don't think the editor is adding alien content.
Oh, so, and bringing up Bultmann, I don't know if he is one of the figures that's been a prominent voice with this theory, but I've heard the theory among I think adherents of Bultmann, and I wondered what you thought of it. And that is, they look at how different John is, and I'm sure you've heard this. You deal with it in your book. You've actually written, just so our listeners know, you've written a couple books on John, right? You have the Riddles of the Fourth Gospel, but I think you have a couple other ones also. Is Amazon the best place, or how can we get your books to study further?
Yeah, people can look at my author's page on Amazon.
Okay.
And I think I will have written or edited about 9 books on John now. So
wow.
Quite a few, and I've got several more to go.
And where can they go to take classes with you? What school or schools are you teaching?
Yes. Well, I'm at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon.
Wow.
I also do an online graduate course for Barclay College in Kansas, and that's on the graduate level. Just this last spring, I was down with you in the Los Angeles area teaching at Chapman University. And
there
I did a course on the Riddle of the Fourth Gospel.
Wow, that's interesting. I've had friends teach there also at Chapman. I'm from Pennsylvania, by the way, and George Fox, as you know, founder of the Quakers, William Penn, who founded our state, was, of course, attracted to him and followed him. You mentioned Boltman. So the theory from some of the, I guess it would be higher criticism, I don't want to misspeak, but is that maybe John was written post-resurrection and infusing how they saw him as divine. So a lot of the I ams or a lot of the quotes attributed to Jesus were not him historically saying those things. And I know you, I think, deal with it in Fourth Riddles. That's been a pretty popular theory. I've been reading Marcus Borg, I think, talks a lot about that theory, and his he has a book on Jesus as well that deals with that theory. Teaching on the college level, I'm sure that comes up. What's your thoughts on well, gee, how do we know he historically said these things? This seems more like the way the church understood him to be the Son of God, God the Son later, in more of a poetic sense or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the view I think that most scholars hold over the last 150 years. Marcus Borg, who actually was a friend of mine, we did several public dialogues together.
Oh, really? I'd love to see that. Are those on YouTube or anything?
Yeah. The recording of those didn't come out very well. They were done at Reedwood Friends Church in Portland, Oregon, in 2010. But he and I took the Gospels and Jesus in what I call bioptic perspective, two different perspectives. So the part of my theory is to see John and Mark as the bioptic Gospels, two different perspectives from day one. So Matthew and Luke built upon Mark. I'm arguing that John builds around Mark and is different on purpose. But let me say a bit more about the real problem that scholars are aware of there. You see, John is also very different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We'll call those the synoptic Gospels, similar and perspective, synoptic. So, let me just mention some of the real problems. True or false, if Jesus really said, I am the true vine, I am the good shepherd, I am the bread of life, those great sayings, if he really said that, how could they not be in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you see? Mm-hmm. And so that's a really good point. Now, Jesus does, in the synoptics, talk about light and resurrection and truth and shepherd and that kind of a thing. But John presents this in a Christocentric way. And so the question that scholars ask is whether that represents the historical Jesus or the narrator's speaking about Jesus. You know, is it his own paraphrase or maybe his theologizing of you know, material to make it relate to Jesus instead of the actual claims of Jesus? Therefore, scholars might question whether John is objective and historical, because it seems to be subjective and theological. And I think those are really good points. In fact, I might see those as paraphrases of Jesus as opposed to actual quotations of Jesus.
Paraphrases? Is that what you said?
As paraphrases or as the evangelist, you know, talking about Jesus in his own terms. Here's what Jesus means to me. You know, he talked about shepherds, you know, and the good shepherd in the synoptics. Well, you know, he is the good shepherd, you see. And so it could be that John takes it further in his own preaching about Jesus and makes the connection in his own theological way. So those might be ways that we would, or good reasons to question whether John is objective and historical in that sense. On the other hand, John has a whole lot of material that seems more historical than Matthew, Mark, or Luke. In Matthew, Mark, or Luke, you have Jesus going to Jerusalem only one time at the end of his ministry, and then they kill him. Well, John has Jesus going to Jerusalem four times or more, back and forth. That seems more realistic. And so you've got a lot of ways in which John seems more historical than Matthew, Mark, or Luke. So one of the things that I've been working with at the National Meetings of Society of Biblical Literature for the last 16 years is the John, Jesus, and History Project. Now, the way scholars have defined this, including the Jesus Seminar, organized, you know, by folks there at Claremont and some other strong institutions, is to say that if we're going to try to make no mistakes, we need to not use the Gospel of John historically. And so let's approach things in the safest way possible, using Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But then they find Gospel of Thomas in the second century. And so, okay, well, maybe some other stuff. But the Jesus Seminar used everything except for John. And so what the John Jesus History Project has tried to do is to ask, well, okay, what if we throw John into the mix? And we still might privilege, you know, synoptic priority in some ways, but it could be that John has some material or some perspectives that might be even more historical than the synoptics. So those are the kinds of questions that we're raising among scholars, and that's actually a book that I'm working on right now for Erdmann's.
John, I've heard different debates on authorship. Is it written by, do we know if it's written by the John that was, he refers to the one that Jesus loved. Was it the young John among the 12? And if so, could that argue that it seems like the Jesus Seminar is saying, let's go with Matthew, Mark, and Luke because they're similar, therefore more historical. But could it be argued that if John is written by this disciple that had maybe somewhere closer, you know, that the, you know, the 12 were closer than the multitudes, or Peter, James, and John seemed to be there in these more momentous times than the other 12. Could it be argued that if John had a unique closeness with Jesus, that gave him more cachet to, yes, say some different things that the others missed? So I guess I'm asking about the authorship, and
yes,
if that would give any more credibility to what's in John,
yes,
that's different.
And that's a really huge aspect of debate right now. I'd say critical scholars think that the one thing that they know is that John the disciple didn't write the Gospel of John. I'm not so sure, though, that judgment is as watertight critically as people think it is. Let me just mention some of the issues. First, the author doesn't name himself. And so you have names of Gospels attributed to different people later on. So the narrator doesn't say, my name is John. The author is claimed to be, apparently by another person, he is the beloved disciple in John 21. And I think that might be the editor talking. So Jesus never said he wouldn't die. He said to Peter, was it to you if he lives till I come again? And so it seems like the editor is saying the beloved disciple is the one who wrote or who narrated these things. And yet the name John is not mentioned. Now, the sons of Zebedee are. And that's also in chapter 21, and that would be James and John. But James, the son of Zebedee, is not mentioned either by name, you see. And so you have anonymity of the author. So one way that scholars have thought about that, like you're suggesting, is to say, well, maybe we have somebody with an inside perspective that's different from the synoptics. Maybe that's why John is different. What critical scholars guess is that, well, maybe, you know, even the attribution of authorship to an eyewitness, maybe that's a way to help John be more authoritative. And so they just argue that that's rhetorical, not historical, and that therefore, you know, John is theological and it's not historical, and therefore it's out of range for historical studies. My view, though, is that all of the other theories for John's composition, and I lay out 12 theories also in Riddles of the Fourth Gospel. I just limit myself to 12. and when you look at the strengths and weaknesses of each of those theories, none of them is all that robust. John probably did have an author. That author probably did have an inside understanding. That author might have disagreed with Mark, even as an apostle. That author might have put things in his own word. And so I'm not impressed by other theories. Oh, maybe it was Lazarus. Jesus loved Lazarus. Well, maybe that's why it's different, not one of the 12. Then again, Jesus loves Mary and Martha and Lazarus in John 11:5. Oh, so maybe 2 out of 3, it's a woman. Well, that would be attractive to me as a feminist scholar. But the fact is that the beloved disciple is referred to with male pronouns. And in the boat after the resurrection, you know, Peter has his clothes off. And so the beloved disciple probably would not be a woman in the boat there. So anyway, alternative theories of John's authorship just are not as compelling as a traditional view. So the way that I go with John's authorship, I think it's plausible that John, the son of Zebedee, had something to do with the tradition. Maybe he's narrating it, doing some of the writing. But there are also, according to second century memory, there are two people named John who are dead, buried in Ephesus, and they're referenced by several second century writers. One is called the elder, one is called the disciple. And if John the Elder is the author of the epistles, as 2 John and 3 John say, this is the elder writing, well, maybe the author of the epistles, John the Elder, maybe he finalizes the work of John the Apostle. So that's kind of my best guess as to how this material came together.
Wow, and time just flying by, but just a couple more questions coming in. We'll be right back. Can you hold on just another few minutes, Professor?
Uh-huh.
Okay, we'll be right back. Some questions coming in from listeners, and we'll be back in about 20 seconds. I'll check those email questions, and we'll be right back with the professor on the Gospel of John.
You search, you probe, your mind, your spirit becomes weary. You find yourself on a journey to find a talk show, not just an ordinary talk show, but a Christian talk show, unlike anything the mind could fathom. Suddenly, your search comes to an end, for up ahead, there's a signpost, your next stop, the Rich Rossi Live Zone.
Well, welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. A question coming in. This is a biggie. Wow. Wow. Brad Shapiro, a Jewish listener, brings up an issue that has been really a tough one through the centuries, is allegations of anti-Semitism in John, because throughout the book it talks about the Jews did this and the Jews did that. And I guess historically some have used those things in an anti-Semitic way. I know Fourth Riddles, you do get into this in the Riddles of the Fourth Gospel, Professor. What's your take on that? Is he talking about specifically the Sanhedrin or certain ruling bodies that were unreceptive to Christ? Or is there any legitimacy to the claim that this book or even misuse of this book has fueled anti-Semitism, which I hate to even ask because I love the Gospel of John so much. It's been so enriching to me spiritually, but it's something that we got to look at, of course, in how it's been used historically.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a huge question. Let me just give a commercial for a book that's coming out next month by Society of Biblical Literature Press. It's called John and Judaism, edited by myself and Alan Culpepper. What we did was to draw in over a dozen of leading scholars around the world and ask them to write their best essays possible on this rough set of issues. My essay is to say that John is not anti-Semitic and that religious violence and anti-Semitism are wrong interpretations of John. And I think that's a fact. So it's also true, though, that John has contributed to anti-Semitism. So has the Gospel of Matthew, and so have the writings of Paul. After all, you have the Greek word judaioi, and that can be translated Jews, but it can also be translated Judeans, okay? And so Jesus goes to Judea, to Judea in the Gospel of John. And so here's the question. Is it that the Judeans reject Jesus, or is it that the Jews reject Jesus? In my analysis of all 72 times that judaios, singular, judaioi, plural, occur in the Gospel of John, none of the general references to Jews are negative, and none of them are ambiguous. They're all neutral or positive. For instance, in John 4, Jesus says, salvation is of the Jews, or this is the Passover of the Jews. And so all of those statements about the Jewish religion, as well as Israel or Israelites, all of those are positive or neutral. The only times where judaioi represents people who reject Jesus is in Jerusalem, where you have Judean leaders who are threatened by the charismatic prophet. So I see the issue more as the charismatic prophet threatening religious hierarchy and institution. And in that sense, Revelation challenges all institutions, including Christian ones. Revelation challenges dogmatism. So I would say that the Gospel of John is the best antidote to fundamentalism and institutional religion. Also, it's the best challenger to institutional atheism. So I'm arguing that the Gospel of John, it does represent tensions with Jewish leaders during the time of Jesus, but also later on as John is finalized in Asia Minor or wherever. People arguing the law of Moses, and John says, wait a minute, Moses said in Deuteronomy 18 that there will be a prophet who comes, his word comes true, therefore Jesus fulfills Moses, of whom the scriptures wrote. So I do think you do have tensions with religious Judaism in the 80s and 90s of the first century, but I don't think that we have the parting of the ways. I don't think it's interfaith dialogue between Jews and Christians. I think it's intrafaith dialectic. Between people who see themselves as Jewish. And in that sense, John is arguing, I think, for the center of Judaism, whereas the Apostle Paul is arguing for the boundaries of Judaism.
Wow, excellent. Thank you. One last question as we're getting down to our final minute. I guess it sounds like a yes or no, but I know your books will answer it more for people to go on Amazon. And so the best thing to get your books is Paul Anderson, Gospel of John. Just search that out on Amazon, I would imagine, right? And just see everything you have.
Yes, that's correct. And I've got my own author's page there. And also on Twitter and on academia and my George Fox University page.
Well, thank you, Professor. The last question, Kathy in Toledo, Ohio. The I Ams in John, I am the Good Shepherd, I am the Light of the World, I am the Bread of Life. Are these tied to the I Am that I Am in Exodus? Are they a motif of Jesus being God, divinity, is the question.
I think you have an association with Exodus 3:14 in chapter 8:58 of John. But you also have that mentioned by Jesus in Mark 12, as Moses, as God said to Moses before the burning bush, I am the God of Israel. And so you can't say that Exodus 3:14 is only in John. It's also in the synoptics. The metaphors, though, I think are not really theophany. They're not really the name of God. They're more images of true Israel, which come true in Jesus.
Well, Professor Anderson, you've really done a fantastic job and also whetted our appetite to study more. So thank you for your time and your wonderful scholarship on this wonderful book of the Bible. And God bless you and your family. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, you're very welcome, Richard. And let's take it further down the road.
I would love to. I hope you can come back on again. God bless you.
Okay, blessings on you too. Bye now.
Bye-bye. And for all of you listening, I'll be back in a quick flash to let you know about our next show. So just stay right there. I'll be back in about 10 seconds.
No, when it comes to talk shows, my friend Harvey's all ears, especially when it comes to listening to Rich Rossi Live.
Thank you for listening to Richard Rossi Live, and we have a big show coming up next Tuesday. Betty Davis, who was a Hollywood legend, an absolute legend, as you know, she starred in a cult classic, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, with her beautiful daughter, B.D. Hyman. Their relationship is the subject of a cable show with Susan Sarandon, called Feud. Well, B.D. Hyman has made a journey from Hollywood to Hollywood. She's now a pastor. She's now a biblical teacher. And she's going to share what it was like, you know, as Betty Davis's daughter, what it's like now, her fantastic journey. So that's next Tuesday. Mark your calendars, 11 a.m. Pacific time. 11 a.m. Pacific time. For those of you on the East Coast, 2 p.m. East Coast time. Beatie Hyman, Betty Davis's daughter. It's going to be a fantastic show. It's been great being with you, and thank you for listening to Richard Rossi Live.
See, they say, don't forget to listen to Rich Rossi Live. So that's it. Sounds like a wise thing to do. Quick, we better find ourselves a radio. Hi-ho, Rich Rossi Live, and away!